Side 6. Eideroo by William Gibson. Continuing on page 259. 39. Trams. Yamazaki lost his balance as the van shot up the narrow ramp out of the hotel. Lainey, holding Arlie's phone to the dashboard map, toning the number of the hotel die, heard him crash down on the shredded bubble pack. The display bleeped as Lainey completed the number. Grid segments clicked across the screen. You okay, Yamazaki?
Thank you,
Yamazaki said.
Yes.
Getting to his knees again, he craned around the headrest of Lainey's seat.
You have located the hotel?
Expressway, Arlie said, glancing at the display as they swung right up an entrance ramp.
Hit speed dial 3. Thanks. Gimme.
She took the phone.
McRae.
Yeah.
Priority? Fuck you, Alex. Ring me through to him.
She listened.
Die? Like D-I? Shit. Thanks.
She clicked off. What is it? Lainey asked, as they swung onto the expressway, the giant, bland brow of an enormous articulated freight hauler pulling up behind and then past them, quilted stainless steel flashing in Lainey's peripheral vision. The van rocked with the big truck's passage.
I tried to get Rez. Alex says he left the hotel with Blackwell, headed the same place we are.
When?
Just about the time you were having your screaming fit, when you had the phones on,
Arlie said.
She looked grim. Sorry, she said.
Lainey had had to argue with her for 15 minutes back there before she'd agreed to this. She'd kept saying she wanted him to see a doctor. She'd said that she was a technician, not a researcher, not security, and that her first responsibility was to stay with the data, the modules, because anyone who got those got almost the entire low-res partnership business plan, plus the books, plus whatever Kuwayama had entrusted them with in the gray module. She'd only given in after Yamazaki had sworn to take full responsibility for everything, and after Shannon and the man with the ponytail had promised not to leave the modules. Not even, Arlie said, to piss. Go against the wall, goddammit, she'd said, and get half a dozen of Blackwell's boys down here to keep you company.
He knows, Lainey said. She told him it's there.
What is there, Lainey-san? Asked Yamazaki around the headrest.
I don't know. Whatever it is, they think it'll facilitate their marriage.
Do you think so?
Arlie asked, passing a string of bright little cars.
I guess it must be capable of it, Lainey said,
as something under her seat began to clang loudly and insistently.
But I don't think that means it'll necessarily happen.
What the hell is that? I'm exceeding the speed limit, she said. Every vehicle in Japan is legally required to be equipped with one of these devices. You speed, it dings.
Lainey turned to Yamazaki.
Is that true?
Of course,
Yamazaki said over the steady clanging. And people don't just disconnect them?
No,
Yamazaki said, looking puzzled.
Why would they?
Arlie's phone rang.
McRae, Willie?
Silence as she listened. Then Lainey felt the van sway slightly. It slowed until the clanging suddenly stopped. She lowered the phone.
What is it? Lainey asked.
Willie Jude, she said. He was just watching one of the clubbing channels. They said Rez is dead. They said he was dead. In a love hotel.
40. The business. When nobody did anything to help Mary Alice, Chia got up from the bed, squeezed past the Russian and into the bathroom, triggering the ambient bird track. The black cabinet was open, its light on, and there were day-glow penis things scattered across the black and white tile floor. She took a black towel and a black washcloth from a heated chrome rack, wet the washcloth at the black and chrome basin, and went back to Mary Alice. She folded the towel, put it down over the vomit on the white carpet, and handed Mary Alice the washcloth. Nobody said anything or tried to stop her. Masahiko had sat back down on the carpet with his computer between his feet. The scarred man, who seemed to take up as much space as anything in the room, had lowered his axe. He held it down along a thigh wider than Chia's hips, with the spike jutting from beside his knee. Mary Alice, who'd managed to sit up now, wiped her mouth with the cloth, taking most of her lipstick with it. When Chia straightened up, a whiff of the Russian's cologne made her stomach heave.
You're a developer, you say?
Rez still held the nanotech unit.
You are asking many questions, the Russian said.
Eddie groaned then, and the Russian kicked him.
Basis, the Russian said.
A public works project?
Rez raised his eyebrows. A water filtration plant, something like that? The Russian kept his eye on the big man's axe.
In Tallinn, he said, we soon are building exclusive mega mall, affluent gated suburbs, plus world-class pharmaceutical manufacturer. We are unfairly denied most advanced means of production, but we are desiring 100% modern operation.
Rez, the man with the axe said, give it up. This hoon and his mates need that thing to build themselves an Estonian drug factory. Tom, I'll take you back to the hotel.
But wouldn't they be more interested in Tokyo real estate?
The big man's eyes bulged, the scars on his forehead reddening. One of the upper arms of the Micropore X had come loose, revealing a deep scratch.
What bullshit is that? You don't have any real estate here.
Famous aspect, Rez said.
Ray's management company. They invest for her. You're discussing nanotech exchange for Tokyo real estate?
The Russian was looking at Rez.
Exactly, Rez said. What kind real estate?
Undeveloped landfill in the bay, an island, one of two, off one of the old toxic necklace sites. But that's been cleaned up since the quake.
Wait a minute, Mary Alice said from the floor. I know you. You were in that band, the one with the skinny Chinese, the guitar player wore the hat. I know you. You were huge.
Rez stared at her.
I think it's not good here to discuss the business, the Russian said, rubbing his birthmark. But I am Starkov, Yevgeny.
He extended his hand, and Chia noticed the laser scars again.
Rez shook it.
Chia thought she heard the big man groan.
I used to watch him in Dayton,
Mary Alice said, as if that proved something. The big man took a small phone from his pocket with his free hand, squinted at the call display, and put it to his left ear, which Chia now saw was missing. He listened. Ta, he said, and lowered the phone. He moved to the window, the one Chia had found behind the wall screen, and stood looking out.
Get to have a look at this, Rosa, he said.
Rez joined him.
She saw Rez touch the monocle.
What are they doing, Keithy? What is it?
It's your funeral,
the big man said. 41. Candlelight and Tears. Office windows flickered past very close beyond the earthquake-bandaged uprights of the expressway. Taller buildings gave way to a lower sprawl, then something bright in the middle distance. Hotel King Midas.
The dashboard map began to bleep. Third exit right, Laney said, watching the cursor.
He felt her accelerate and heard the speed limit warning kick in. Another glittering sign. Freedom Shower Bank.
Laney-san, Yamazaki said around the headrest. Did you apprehend any suggestion of Rez's death or other misfortune?
No, but I wouldn't. Not unless there was a degree of intentionality that would emerge from the data. Accidents, actions by anyone who isn't represented.
The clanging stopped as she slowed, approaching the exit indicated on the map.
But I saw their data as streams, merging. And whatever it was merging around seemed to be where we're going.
Arlie made the exit. They were on the off-ramp now, swinging through a curve. And Laney saw three young girls, their shoes clumped with mud, descending a sharp slope planted with some kind of pale, rough grass. One of them seemed to be wearing a school uniform, knee socks and a short plaid skirt. They looked unreal in the harsh, sodium light of the intersection. But then Arlie stopped the van, and Laney turned to see the road in front of them completely blocked by a silent, unmoving crowd.
Jesus,
Arlie said. The fans. If there were boys in the crowd, Laney didn't see them. It was a level sea of glossy black hair. Every girl facing the white building that rose there with its white, brilliantly illuminated sign framed by something meant to represent a coronet. Hotel Di. Arlie powered down her window, and Laney heard the distant wail of a siren. We'll never get through, Laney said. Most of the girls held a single candle, and the combined glow danced among the tear-streaked faces. They were so young, these girls. Children. Kathy Torrance had particularly loathed that about low-res, the way their fan base had refreshed itself over the years with a constant stream of pubescent recruits, girls who fell in love with Rez and the endless present of the net, where he could still be the 20-year-old of his earliest hits. "Pass me that black case," Arlie said, and Lainey heard Yamazaki scrabbling through the bubble pack. A flat rectangular carrying case appeared between the seats. Lainey took it. "Open it," she said. Lainey undid the zip, exposing something flat and gray. The low-res logo on an oblong sticker. Arlie pulled it from its case, put it on the dashboard, and ran her finger around its edge looking for a switch. "Low-res," mirror reversed in large luminous green letters appeared on the windshield. Asterisk, asterisk, tour support vehicle, asterisk, asterisk. The asterisks began to flash. Arlie let the van roll forward a few inches. The girls directly in front turned, saw the windshield, and stepped aside. Silently, gradually, a few feet at a time, the crowd parted for the van. Lainey looked out across the black, center-parted heads of the grieving fans and saw the Russian, the one from the Western world, still in his white leather evening jacket, struggling through the crowd. The girl's heads came barely to his waist, and he looked as though he were wading through black hair and candle glow. The expression on his face was one of confusion, almost of terror. But when he saw Lainey at the window of the green van, he grimaced and changed course, heading straight for them. 42. Checking out. Chia looked out and saw that the rain had stopped. Beyond the chain-link fence, the parking lot was full of small, unmoving figures holding candles. A few of them were standing on the tops of the trucks parked there, and there seemed to be more on the roof of the low building behind. Girls. Japanese girls. All of them seemed to be staring at the hotel die. The big man was telling Rez that someone had announced that he'd died, that he'd been found dead in this hotel, and it was out on the net and was being treated like it had really happened. The Russian had produced his own phone now and was talking to someone in Russian. "Mr. Loris," he said, lowering the phone. "We are hearing police come. This nanotech being heavily proscribed is a serious problem." "Fine," Rez said. "We have a car in the garage." Someone nudged Chia's elbow. It was Masahiko, handing her her bag. He'd put her sandbenders in it and zipped it up. She could tell by the weight. He had his computer in the plaid bag. "Put your shoes on now," he said. His were already on. Eddie was curled into a knot on the carpet. He'd been like that since the Russian had kicked him. Now the Russian took a step toward him again, and Chia saw Mary Alice cringe, where she sat beside Eddie on the carpet. "You're lucky men," the Russian said to Eddie. "We're honoring our agreement, isotope to be delivered. But we are wanting no more the business with you." There was a click, and another, and Chia watched as the big man with no left ear folded his axe, collapsing it smoothly into itself without looking at it.
"That thing you're holding is a heavy crime, Rosa. Your fan club turned out bringing the police.
Better let me be in possession." Rez looked at the big man.
"I'll carry it myself, Keithy."
Chia thought she saw a sudden sadness in the big man's eyes.
"Well then," he said, "time to go."
He slipped the folded weapon inside his jacket.
"Come on then, you two,"
gesturing Chia and Masahiko toward the door. Rez followed Masahiko, the Russian close behind him. But Chia saw that the room key was on top of the little fridge. She ran over and grabbed it. Then she stopped, looking down at Mary Alice. Mary Alice's mouth, with her lipstick gone, looked old and sad. It was a mouth that must have been hurt a lot, Chia thought.
"Come with us," Chia said.
Mary Alice looked at her.
"Come on," Chia said. "The police are coming."
"I can't," Mary Alice said. "I have to take care of Eddie."
"Tell your Eddie," Blackwell said, reaching Chia in two steps, "that if he whines to anyone about any of this, he'll be grabbed and his shoe size shortened."
But Mary Alice didn't seem to hear. Or if she did, she didn't look up.
And the big man pulled Chia out of the room, closed the door, and then Chia was following the back of the Russian's tan suit down the narrow corridor, his fancy cowboy boots illuminated by the ankle-high light strips. Rez was stepping into the elevator with Masahiko and the Russian when the big man caught his shoulder. "You're staying with me," he said, shoving Chia into the elevator. Masahiko pushed the button.
"You're having vehicle?" the Russian asked Masahiko.
"No,"
Masahiko said.
The Russian grunted.
His cologne was making Chia's stomach turn over. The door opened on the little lobby. The Russian pushed past her, looked around. Chia and Masahiko followed. The elevator door closed.
"Looking for vehicle," the Russian said.
"Come."
They followed him through the sliding glass door into the parking area, where Eddie's Graceland seemed to take up at least half the available space. Beside it was a silver-gray Japanese sedan, and Chia wondered if that was Rez's. Someone had put black plastic rectangles over the license plates of both cars. She heard the glass door hiss open again and turned to see Rez coming out, the nanotech unit tucked beneath his arm like a football. The big man was behind him. Then, a really angry man in a shiny white tuxedo burst through the pink plastic strips that hung down across the entrance. He had a smaller man by the collar of his jacket, and the smaller man was trying to get away. Then the smaller man saw them there and shouted, "Blackwell!" and actually managed to slip right out of his jacket. But the man in the white tuxedo reached down with the other hand and caught him by the belt. The Russian was yelling in Russian now, and the man in the white tuxedo seemed to see him for the first time. He let go of the other man's belt.
"We got the van," the other man said.
The big man with the missing ear stepped up really close to the man in the white tuxedo, glared at him, and took the other man's jacket.
"Okay, Raza," he said, turning to Rez. "You know the drill this one. Old hat. Same as leaving that house in St. Kilda with the bastard Melbourne tabs outside, right?"
He draped the jacket over Rez's head and shoulders, slapped him encouragingly on the upper arm. He walked over to the pink strips and drew one aside, looking out.
"Fucking hell," he said. "Right then, all of you. It's move fast, stay together. Rez in the center and into the van. On my count of three."
43. Toe Cutter's Breakfast.
"You aren't eating," Blackwell said, after he'd cleared his second plate of links and eggs.
He'd appropriated this dining room on one of the Elfhat's executive floors and insisted Lainey join him. The view was similar to the one from Lainey's room, six floors below, and sunlight was glinting from the distant parapets of the new buildings. Who put out the word that Rez was dead, Blackwell? The Ida room?
Hat? What do you think she would?
He was using the edge of a triangle of toast to squeegee his plate.
"I don't know," Lainey said. "But she seems to like to do things, and they aren't necessarily that easy to understand."
"It wasn't her," Blackwell said. "We're checking it out. Looks as though some fan of his in Mexico went berserk. Used some fairly drastic sort of wear weapon on the Tokyo Club central site. Took that over from a converted corporate website in the States and issued the bulletin. Called on every fan local to Tokyo to get up immediately and go to that love hotel."
He popped the toast into his mouth, swallowed, and wiped his lips with a thick white napkin.
"But Rez was there," Lainey said.
Blackwell shrugged.
"We're looking into it. We have more than enough on our hands now. Have to dissociate Lo Rez from this death hoax, reassure his audience. Legal's flying in from London and New York for talks with Starkov and his people. Their people, too," he added. "Going to be busy."
"Who were those kids?" Lainey asked. "The little redhead and the Japanese hippie."
"Rez says they're okay. Have him here in the hotel. Ollie's sorting it out."
"Where's the nanotech unit?"
"You didn't say that," Blackwell said. "Now, don't say it again. The official truth of the night's events is currently being formulated, and that will never be a part of it. Am I understood?"
Lainey nodded. He looked out at the new buildings again. Either the angle of light had changed, or that parapet had shifted slightly. He looked at Blackwell.
"Is it my imagination, or has your attitude on all this undergone some kind of change? I thought you were adamantly opposed to Rez and the Idaru getting together."
Blackwell sighed.
"I was. But it's starting to look like something of a done deal now, isn't it? De facto relationship, really.
I suppose I'm old-fashioned. But I'd hope that he might eventually wind up with a bit of the ordinary. Someone to polish his gun, pick up his socks, have a baby or two. But it isn't going to happen, is it?
I guess not.
In which case, Blackwell said, I have two options. Either I leave the silly bastard to his own resources, or I stay and I do my job and try to adjust to whatever it is this is going to become. And at the end of the bloody day, Laney, regardless, I have to remember where I'd be if he hadn't come behind the walls of Pentridge to give that solo concert. Aren't you going to eat that?
Looking at the scrambled eggs going cold on Laney's plate. My job's done, Laney said. It didn't work out the way you wanted it to, but I did it. Agreed?
No question.
Then I'd better go.
Get me paid off. I'm out of here today. Blackwell looked at him with new interest.
That fast, eh?
What's your hurry? Don't find us agreeable.
No, Laney said. It's just that way's better all round.
Not what Yama's saying. Rez either. Not to mention Herathenus, who no doubt will voice an opinion in that regard. I'd say you were set to become the court prognosticator, Laney. Unless, of course, that whole business with the Combinat turns out to be absolute bollocks and it's discovered that you simply make that nodal nonsense up. Which I, for one, would actually find quite amusing. But no, your services are very much desired now. You might even say required. And none of us would currently be happy to see you go.
I have to, Laney said. I'm being blackmailed.
This brought Blackwell's lids to half-mast. He leaned slightly forward. The pink worm of scar tissue squirmed in his eyebrow. Are you? He said softly, as though Laney had just ventured to confess some unusual sexual complication. And may I ask who by?
Slitscan, Kathy Torrance. It's sort of personal for her.
Tell me about it. Tell me all about it, too.
And Laney did.
Including the 5SB trials and their record for eventually turning the participants into homicidal stalkers of celebrities.
I didn't want to bring that up before, Laney said, because I was afraid you might think I was at risk, that I might go that way.
Not that I haven't had experience with the type, Blackwell said. We have a young man in Tokyo right now who is the author of all of the songs Lo and Rez have ever written, not to mention Blue Ahmed's complete output for Chrome Koran. And he's an explosives expert. Watch him closely. But we have that capacity, you see. So, the safest place for you, Laney, in the event you go werewolf on us, would be right here, at the watchful heart of our security apparatus.
Laney thought about it.
It almost made sense.
But you won't want me around if Slitscan runs that footage. I won't want myself around. I don't have any family, nobody else for it to damage, but I'm still going to have to live with it.
And how do you propose to do that?
I'll go somewhere where people don't watch that shit.
Well, said Blackwell, when you find that fair land, I will go there with you myself. We'll live on fruit and nuts, commune with all that's left of bloody nature. But till then, Laney, I'm going to have a conversation with your Kathy Torrance. I will explain certain things to her, nothing complicated, simple, simple protocols of cause and effect. And she will never allow Slitscan to run that footage of your doppelganger.
Blackwell, Laney said, she dislikes me. She has her motive for revenge. But she needs to destroy Rez. She's a very powerful woman in a very powerful, fully global organization. Some simple threat of violence on your part isn't going to stop her. It'll only up the ante. She'll go to her security people.
No, said Blackwell. She won't. Because that would be a violation of the very personal terms I will have established in our conversation. That's the key word here, Laney. Personal. Up close and. We will not meet. We will not carve out this deep and meaningful and bloody unforgettable episode of mutual FaceTime as representatives of our respective faceless corporations. Not at all. It's one-on-one time for your Kathy and I. And it may well prove to be as intimate, and I may hope enlightening, as any she ever had. Because I will bring a new certainty into her life, and we all need certainty. They help build character. And I will leave your Kathy with the deepest possible conviction that if she crosses me, she will die. But only after she's been made to desire that. Absolutely. And Blackwell smiled then.
giving Lainey the full benefit of his dental prosthesis, was hideous.
Now, how was it exactly you were supposed to contact her, to give her your decision?
Lainey found his wallet, produced the blank card with the penciled number. Blackwell took it.
Ta. He stood up. Shame to waste a good breakfast that way. Bring the hotel doctor from your room and get yourself sorted. Sleep. I'll deal with this.
He tucked the card into the breast pocket of his aluminum jacket. And as Blackwell left the room, Lainey noticed, centered on the bodyguard's squeegeed plate and standing upright on its broad, flat head, a 1.5-inch galvanized roofing nail. Lainey's ribs, an ugly patchwork of yellow, black, and blue, were sprayed with various cool liquids and tightly bound with micropore. He took the hypnotic the doctor had offered, showered at great length, climbed into bed, and was suggesting the light turn itself off when a fax was delivered. It was addressed to C. Lainey, guest. Day manager gave me my walking papers, fraternizing. Anyway, I'm security here at the Lucky Dragon, midnight on. You can get me fax, email, phones, biz only, but the people are okay. Hope you're okay. Feel responsible. Hope you're enjoying Japan, whatever. Rydell. Good night, Lainey said, putting the fax on the bedside module, and fell instantly and very deeply asleep. And stayed that way until Arlie phoned from the lobby to suggest a drink. 9 in the evening by the blue clock in the corner of the module screen. Lainey put on freshly ironed underwear and his other blue Malaysian button-down. He discovered that white leather tuxedo had sprung a few seams in his only jacket. But then the boss, Russian Starkov, hadn't let the man come with them in the van, so Lainey figured they were even. Crossing the lobby, he encountered a frantic-looking Rice Daniels, so tense that he'd reverted to the black head clamp of his out-of-control days.
Lainey, Jesus! Have you seen Kathy?
No, I've been asleep.
Daniels did a strange little jig of anxiety, rising on the toes of his brown calfskin loafers.
Look, this is too fucking weird, but I swear, I think she's been abducted.
Have you called the police?
We did, but it's all fucking Martian, all these forms they tick through on their notebooks. And what blood type was she? You don't know what blood type she is, do you, Lainey?
Thin, Lainey said, sort of straw-colored. But Daniels didn't seem to hear. He seized Lainey's shoulder and showed him teeth, a rictus intended somehow to indicate friendship.
I have real respect for you, man. How you don't have any issues.
Lainey saw Arlie wave to him from the entrance to the lounge. She was wearing something short and black. You take care, Rice, shaking the man's cold hand. She'll turn up. I'm sure of it. And then he was walking toward Arlie, smiling. And he saw that she was smiling back.
Forty-four. La Purissima. Chia was on the bed watching television. It made her feel more normal. It was like a drug that way. She remembered how much television her mother had watched after her father had left. But this was Japanese television, where girls who could have been Mitsuko, only a little younger, wearing sailor suit dresses, were spinning huge wooden tops at a long table. They could really spin them, too, keep them up forever. It was a contest. The console could translate, but it was even more relaxing not to know what they were saying. The most relaxing parts of all were the close-ups of the tops spinning. She'd used the translation to check out the NHK coverage of the death hoax on the net and the candlelight vigil at the Hotel Dai. She'd seen a very satisfyingly pudgy Hiromi Ogama denying she knew who had nuked her chapter's site and then issued the call to mourning from its ruins. It had not been a member of the club, Hiromi had stressed, either locally or internationally. Chia knew Hiromi was lying, because it had to have been Zona, but the low-res people would be telling her what to say. Arlie had told Chia the whole thing had been launched out of a disused website that belonged to an aerospace company in Arizona, which meant that Zona had blown her country, because now she wouldn't be able to go back there. Nice as Arlie seemed to be, Chia hadn't told her anything about Zona. And she'd seen the helicopter shots of the vigil,
and of the baffled tactical squads facing an estimated 2,500 teary-eyed girls. The injury count was low, everything fairly minor, except for one girl who'd slid down a freeway embankment and broken both her ankles. The real problem had been getting everyone out of there, because a lot of them had arrived 5 or 6 to a cab and had no way of getting home. Some had taken the family car and then abandoned it in their hurry to reach the vigil, and that had created another kind of mess. There had been a few dozen arrests, mostly for trespassing. And she'd seen the message Rez had recorded, assuring people he was alive and well and regretting the whole thing, which of course he'd had nothing to do with. He wasn't wearing the monocle rig for this, but he had on the same black suit and t-shirt. He looked thinner, though. Someone had tweaked it. He'd played it light at first, grinning, saying he'd never been to the Hotel Di, and in fact had never visited a love hotel, but now maybe he should. Then he'd turned serious and said how sorry he was that people had been inconvenienced and even hurt by someone's irresponsible prank. And he'd capped it, smiling, by saying that the whole thing had been quite uniquely moving for him, because how often do you get to watch your own funeral? And she'd seen the people who owned and managed the Hotel Di expressing their regret. They had no idea, they said, how any of this had happened. She got the feeling that expressing regret was a big thing here, but the owners of the Di had also managed to explain how there was no on-site staff at their hotel in the interest of the guests' greater privacy. Arlie, watching this, had said that that was the commercial, and that she bet the place was going to be booked solid for the next 2 months. It was famous now. All in all, the coverage seemed to treat the whole thing as some kind of silly season item that might have had serious repercussions if the police hadn't acted as calmly and as skillfully as they eventually had, bringing in electric buses from the suburbs to ferry the girls to collection points around the city. Arlie was from San Francisco, and she worked for Low Res and knew Res personally, and she was the one who'd driven the van out through the crowd. And then she'd lost a police helicopter by doing something completely crazy on that expressway, a kind of U-turn right over the concrete bumper thing down the middle. She'd brought Chia and Masahiko to this hotel and put them in these adjoining rooms with weirdly angled corners where they each had a private bath. She'd asked them both to please stay there and not to port or use the phone without telling her, except for room service. And then she'd gone out. Chia had had a shower right away. It was the best shower she'd ever had, and she felt like she never wanted to wear those clothes again as long as she lived. She didn't even want to have to look at them. She found a plastic bag you were supposed to put your clothes in to be laundered, and she put them in that and put it in the wastebasket in the bathroom. Then she'd put on all clean clothes from her bag, everything kind of wrinkled, but it felt great, and she'd blow-dried her hair with the machine built into the bathroom wall. The toilet didn't talk, and it only had 3 buttons to figure out. Then she lay down on the bed and fell asleep, but not for long. Arlie kept popping in to make sure Chia was okay and telling her news, so that Chia felt like she was part of it, whatever it was. Arlie said Rez was back at his own hotel now, but that he'd come later to spend some time with her and thank her for all she'd done. That made Chia feel strange. Now she'd seen him in real life. Somehow that had taken over from all the other ways she'd known him before, and she felt kind of funny about him, confused. Like all of this had pegged him in real time for her, and she kept thinking of her mother complaining that Lo and Rez were nearly as old as she was. And there was something else to it, too, that came from what she'd seen when she was crouched down in the back of that van, between the little Japanese guy with the sleeve of his jacket hanging down and Masahiko. She'd looked out the window and seen the faces as the van inched away, none of them knowing that that was Rez hunched down in there under a jacket, but maybe sensing it somehow, and something in Chia letting her know she'd never quite be like that again. Never as comfortably a face in that crowd, because now she knew there were rooms they never saw or even dreamed of where crazy things, or even just boring things, happened, and that was where the stars came from. And it was something like that that worried her now when she thought of Rez coming to see her. That, and how he really was her mother's age. And all of that made her wonder what she was going to tell the others back in Seattle. How could they understand it? She thought Zona would understand. She really wanted to talk with Zona, but Arlie had said it was better not to try to reach her now. The longest-running top was starting to teeter, and they were cutting from that to the eyes of the girl who'd spun it. Masahiko opened the door that connected their rooms. The top gave a last wobble and kicked over.
The girl covered her mouth with her hands, her eyes filled with the pain of defeat.
You must come with me to Walled City now, Masahiko said.
Chia used the manual remote to turn the television off.
Arlie asked us not to port.
She knows, Masahiko said. I've been there all day.
He was wearing the same clothes, but everything had been cleaned and pressed, and the legs of his baggy black pants looked strange with creases in them.
And on the phone with my father.
Is he pissed off at you because those Gumi guys came?
Arlie McRae asked Stockoff to have someone speak with our Gumi representative. They have apologized to my father. But Mitsuko was arrested near Hotel Dai. That has caused him embarrassment and difficulty.
Arrested?
For trespassing. She went to take part in the vigil. She climbed a fence, triggering an alarm. She could not climb back out before the police came.
Is she okay?
My father has arranged her release, but he is not pleased.
I feel like it's my fault,
Chia said. He shrugged and went back through the door. Chia got up. Her sandbenders was beside her bag on the luggage rack with her goggles and tip sets on top of it. She carried it into the other room. It was a mess. Somehow he'd managed to turn it into something like his room at home. The sheets were tangled on the bed. Through the open bathroom door, she saw towels crumpled up on the tiled floor, a spilled bottle of shampoo on the counter beside the sink. He'd set his computer on the desk with his student cap beside it. There were opened mini cans of espresso everywhere, and at least three room service trays with half-empty ceramic bowls of ramen.
Has anyone there seen Zona?
She asked, shoving a pillow and an open magazine aside on the foot of the bed. She sat down with her sandbenders on her lap and started putting her tip sets on. She thought he gave her a strange look then.
I don't think so, he said.
Take me in the way you did the first time,
she said.
I want to see it again.
Haknam, Taichung Street. The walls alive with shifting messages in the characters of every written language. Doorways flipping past, each one hinting at its own secret world. And this time, she was more aware of the countless watching ghosts. That must be how people presented here when you weren't in direct communication with them. A city of ghost shadows. But this time Masahiko took another route, and they weren't climbing the twisted labyrinth of stairs, but winding in at what would have been ground level in the original city. And Chia remembered the black hole, the rectangular vacancy he'd pointed out on the printed scarf in his room at the restaurant.
I must leave you now,
he said, as they burst from the maze into that vacancy.
They wish privacy.
He was gone. And at first Chia thought there was nothing there at all, only the faint grayish light filtering down from somewhere high above. When she looked up at this, it resolved into a vast, distant skylight very far above her, but littered with a compost of strange and discarded shapes. She remembered the city's rooftops and the things abandoned there.
It is strange, isn't it?
The Eideru stood before her in embroidered robes, the tiny bright patterns lit from within, moving.
Hollow and somber.
But he insisted we meet you here. Who insisted? Do you know where Zona is?
And there was a small table, or four-legged stand, in front of the Eideru, very old, its dragon-carved legs thick with flaking pale green paint. A single dusty glass stood centered there, something coiled inside it. Someone coughed.
This is the heart of Haknam,
the Etruscan said. That same creaking voice assembled from a million samples of dry old sounds.
Traditionally, a place of serious conversation.
Your friend is gone, the Eideru said.
I wished to tell you myself.
This one, indicating the glass,
volunteers details I do not understand.
But they've only shut down her website, Chia said. She's in Mexico City with her gang.
She is nowhere,
the Etruscan said.
When you were taken from her,
the Eideru said.
Taken from the room in Venice. Your friend went to your system software and activated the video units in your goggles. What she saw there indicated to her that you were in grave danger, as I believe you were. She must then have decided on a plan. Returning to her secret country, she linked her site with that of the Tokyo chapter of the Low Res Group. She ordered Ogawa, the president of the group,
to post the message announcing Rez's death at Hotel Dai. She threatened her with a weapon that would shatter the Tokyo chapter's sight.
The knife?
Chia said.
It was real?
And extremely illegal,
the Etruscan said. When Ogawa refused, the Eideru said, your friend used her weapon.
A serious crime,
the Etruscan said,
under the laws of every country involved.
She then posted her message through what remained of Ogawa's website, the Eideru said. It seemed official, and it had the effect of quickly surrounding Hotel Dai with a sea of potential witnesses.
Whatever the next stage of her plan,
the Etruscan said,
she had exposed her presence in her website. The original owners became aware of her. She abandoned her site. They pursued her. She was forced to discard her persona.
What persona?
Chia felt a sinking feeling.
Zona Rosa, said the Etruscan, was the persona of Mercedes Purissima Vargas Gutierrez. She is 26 years old and the victim of an environmental syndrome occurring most frequently in the Federal District of Mexico.
His voice was like rain on a thin metal roof now.
Her father is an extremely successful criminal lawyer.
Then I can find her,
Chia said. But she would not wish this, the Eideru said. Mercedes Purissima is severely deformed by the syndrome and has lived for the past 5 years in almost complete denial of her physical self. Chia was sitting there crying. Masahiko removed the black cups from his eyes and came over to the bed.
Sona's gone,
she said.
I know, he said.
He sat down beside her.
You never finished telling me the story of the sandbenders, he said. It was a very interesting story.
So she began to tell it to him. 45. Lucky.
Lainey?
He heard her say, her voice blurred with sleep.
What are you doing?
The illuminated face of the cedar telephone. I'm calling the Lucky Dragon on Sunset.
The what?
Convenience store, 24 hours.
Lainey, it's 3 in the morning.
Have to thank Rydell. Tell him the job worked out. She groaned and rolled over, pulling the pillow over her head. Through the window, he could see the translucent amber, the serried cliffs of the new building, reflecting the lights of the city. 46. Fables of the Reconstruction. Chia dreamed of a beach pebbled with crushed fragments of consumer electronics. Crab things scuttling low, their legs striped like antique resistors. Tokyo Bay, shrouded in fog from an old movie. A pale gray blanket meant to briefly conceal first-act terrors. Sea monsters or some alien armada. Hak Nam rose before her as she waded nearer, but with a dream's logic, it grew no closer. Backwashing sea sucking at her ankles. The walled city is growing, being grown, from the fabric of the beach, rack and wreckage of the world before things changed. Unthinkable tonnage, dumped here by barge and bulk lifter in the course of the Great Reconstruction. The minuscule bugs of Rodel Van Erp seethe there, lifting the iron-caged balconies that are sleeping rooms, countless unplanned windows throwing blank silver rectangles back against the fog. A thing of random human accretion, monstrous and superb, it is being reconstituted here, retranslated from its later incarnation as a realm of consensual fantasy. The alarms, infrared stutter. Sunbright halogen illuminating the printed scarf, at its center the rectangle representing an emptiness, an address unknown, the kill file of legend. Zapping the espresso-matic to life with her remote, she curls back into the quilt's dark, waiting for the building hiss of steam. Most mornings now, she checks into the city, hears the gossip in a favorite barber shop in Saixing Road. The Etruscan is there sometimes, with Klaus and the rooster and the other ghosts he hangs with. And they tolerate her. She's proud of that, because they'll clam up around Masahiko. Are they old, incredibly ancient, or do they just act that way? Whatever. They tend to know things first, and she's learned to value that. and the Etruscan has been hinting at a vacancy, something really small,
but with a window,
looking down into what would have been Lung Chun Road.
He likes her, the Etruscan. It's weird.
They say he doesn't like anybody, really, but he fixed her father's credit, even though she'd forgotten to leave the key. She keeps the key to Suite 17 in a watered silk cosmetics case they gave her on the JAL flight home. It's made of white plastic, molded to look like an old-fashioned mechanical key, with a mag strip down the long part, and the flat thing shaped like the crown a princess wears. She gets it out and looks at it sometime, but it just looks like a cheap white piece of plastic. The Etruscan and the others spy on the project all the time. That's what they call it. Through them, Chia knows that the Eideru's island isn't finished yet. It's there, but it isn't stable. Something they have to do before they build, even with nanotech in case another earthquake comes. She wonders what the Russians will do with theirs. And sometimes she wonders about Mary Alice and Eddie and Calvin, the guy at Whiskey Clone who got her out of there for no reason other than he thought he should. But it seems like a long time ago, between the walled city and school. She figures her mother knows by now that she wasn't with Hester, but her mother's never said anything about it, except to talk to her twice about contraceptives and safe sex. And really, she wasn't there much more than 48 hours, if you didn't count the travel time, because Rez hadn't been able to make it over to thank her, and Arlie had said that all in all, it was better if she got home before anybody started asking any questions. But they'd send her first class on Japan Airlines. So Arlie had driven her back out to Narita that night, but not in her green van, because she said it was a write-off. And she'd still felt so bad about Zona, and it made her feel so stupid, because she felt like her friend was dead. But her friend hadn't even really existed. And there was this other girl in Mexico City with terrible problems. And so she wound up telling all that to Arlie, and just crying. And Arlie said she should just wait. Because that girl in Mexico City, more than anything else, needed to be somebody else. And it didn't matter that she hadn't been Zona, because she'd made Zona up, and that was just as real. Just wait, Arlie said. Because somebody else would turn up, somebody new, and it would be like they already knew you. And Chia had sat and thought about that, beside Arlie in her fast little car. But I could never tell her I knew. That would spoil it. When they'd gotten to the airport, Arlie checked her in at JAL, found somebody to take her to the lounge, which was sort of like a cross between a bar and a really fancy business office, and gave her a bag with a roadie-grade low-res tour jacket in it. The sleeves were made of transparent rayon, and the lining that showed through that looked like liquid mercury. Arlie said it was really tacky, but maybe she had a friend who'd like it. It was from their Combinat tour, and it had all the tour dates embroidered on the back in three different languages. She had never worn it, and she'd never really shown it to anybody either. It was hanging in her closet under a piece of dry cleaner's plastic. She hadn't really been that active in the chapter lately. Kelsey had dropped right out. Chia didn't really feel that anybody in the chapter would get it if she tried to tell them what had happened. Plus, there were all the bits she couldn't tell them anyway. But mainly it was the city taking up her time, because Rez and Ray were there, shadows among the other shadows, but still you could tell, working on their project. Plenty there who didn't like the idea, but plenty who did. The Etruscan did. He said it was the craziest thing since they'd turned that first kill file inside out. Sometimes Chia wondered if they all weren't just joking, because it just seemed impossible that anyone could ever do that. Build that on an island in Tokyo Bay. But the Eideru said that was where they wanted to live now that they were married, so they were going to do it. And if they do, Chia thought, hearing the hiss of the Espressomatic, I'll go there. End of Eideru by William Gibson. Read by Christopher Hurt in the studios of American Foundation for the Blind, Incorporated for the Library of Congress, March 1997. Published by G.P. Putnam Sons, 200 Madison Avenue, New York, New York, 10016. Further reproduction or distribution in other than a specialized format is prohibited. If you found any cassette in this book to be defective, please place a rubber band or piece of string around that cassette for identification. Place it in the container on top of the front stack of cassettes.